John.
Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're going to have some public hearings today and possible work sessions. We also have a possible measure for introduction as a committee bill. And Council, why don't we start off with the introduction information for the committee bill, which is LC, I do have a couple
LC, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
2535.
It's LC 2535, and what it does, it repeals statutes and imposes liability in plaintiff's attorney for costs awarded to defendant when plaintiff resides outside the state or is a foreign corporation.
Okay. So, as in the past, these are bills that we introduce as committee bills. No one is obligated in the future to support them. It's just a means of getting various matters before the legislature. There's no guarantee that these bills, but this one looks like it more than likely would come back to the Judiciary Committee. But with that, Senator Boquist, do you have a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves LC 2535 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now we're going to start our public hearings. We're going to start with Senate Bill 86, so I'll start with a public hearing on that bill there. And we have Glenn Chastain, I believe, scheduled to give us testimony on that. When you're ready.
Good morning, Representative and members of the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, and I am here today to in support of Senate Bill 86, which is simply to change current statute that states that the superintendent of the Oregon State Police is responsible for the security and the information that is needed for extradition for persons being extradited back into the state of Oregon. This authority has not been exercised by the state police superintendent, and it is actually the extradition officer from the governor's office that is one is responsible for the security and the information that is needed for extradition for people back into the state of Oregon. And this bill literally has no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon and is simply a housekeeping change that changes statute to remove the superintendent of state police from the current statute. And for all intents and purposes, it's literally a housekeeping change that changes current statute and removes state police superintendent from the statute. And I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time if you have any questions about this bill.
Thank you, Lieutenant. My understanding, we're reviewing the bill that basically is going to delete from there basically two phrases, and as you're saying, currently the statute requires under the, I guess, the final determination of the governor for the superintendent of the state police to do these various things, but in reality, the governor's office is actually doing it, and the it's just a formality at this point that the superintendent of state police is kind of, let's say, engaged in a secondary level, and really everything's being done by the governor's office. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely correct, and this does not change it doesn't change that the governor's office can consult with the superintendent of state police for should the governor's office need have some consultation, the superintendent still can be a part of that process, but this just removes the superintendent from the statute that requires that the superintendent be part of that process.
And I think, as we all know, the governor, being the chief of the executive branch, would be able to probably consult with anyone that's within that arena.
Mr. Chair, absolutely correct.
Thank you. Senator Wessett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Lieutenant Chastain, do you have some idea of the reason why the Superintendent of State Police was originally included in the in the statute?
This statute was, Mr. Chair and Senator Wessett, this statute was actually changed in 1999. I was not part of that whole process. I do not know the actual reason why the superintendent was put into that, into the statute. So I cannot answer that question. There is people from the governor's office here that may be able to give some historical perspective on that. But no, I do not know specifically why the superintendent was actually added to the statute.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just briefly, if you know, how many extraditions are we talking about a year? And then my understanding of the situation is the governor has a state police detail, which works for the governor, but is seconded from the superintendent. And that I'm assuming that detail is the one that establishes what the security requirement is for the governor. So they actually still work for the superintendent and the governor. And if that's not the case, then who's the person in the governor's office that has the law enforcement experience to make the determination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the governor's office actually has an extradition officer that actually is the one that is responsible for the extradition from other states back into Oregon. And like I said, there is representatives from the governor's office here that probably could answer those questions specifically. And I'm not the one that, like I said, I wasn't around in 1999 to be able to actually answer specifically why Superintendent of State Police was actually added into the statute.
How about if I do this? I see Miss Guy kind of hiding in the back. She wasn't jumping up and down, so I didn't think she expected to testify. But Kelly, if you or someone else from the governor's office wants to come up and maybe fill in some of the blanks for us, that'd be great.
Brent.
Good morning, Kelly Sky. I'm general counsel to Governor Kulongoski, and I brought up with me Fran Lushenko, who is the governor's extradition officer and has served as the state's extradition officer since 1987. So I'm actually going to ask her to respond to your questions.
You got the certified smart people here. That's great. Ms. Lushenko.
Again, my name is Fran Lushenko. I'm the director of extradition services for the governor. I've held that position since 1987. So, Mr. Chair, did you want me to address Senator Witzel's question first about the background of why the superintendent was language was put into the statute?
We'll let you answer him however you'd like to.
Okay.
Sounds like you got him loaded up for either way.
Okay. members of the committee, Mr. Chair, the statute that was developed in 1999 was put in place because at the time, the funding for extraditions provided by the state only limited it to one officer per extradition. The counties were able to provide funding for a second officer at their own expense. There was some concern about officers transporting fugitives and the officer safety concern and safety of the public. So this statute was put in place to assist the governor in making the decision. However, it was never used because the funding situation was rectified. The situation now is that the arrest and return budget, which funds extraditions, now the default is two officers go on every trip. The counties now have the option of just sending one, depending on the criminal history of the individual being returned. So the safety issue is off the table at this point.
Other questions based on the response?
Chair, number of extraditions, and I'm assuming since you've been this since 87, BPSD qualified, so on and so forth like that. I mean, what's the qualifications for your position?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Senator Boquist, I'm not a certified law enforcement officer. I defer to the county's law enforcement officers that are going on the trip. On the extradition, I defer to their judgment as to safety concerns, and they are also, they need to abide by FAA regulations when transporting individuals by commercial airlines also, which requires two officers most of the time.
Follow-up, last question.
Yes.
On average, the number of extraditions per year?
Whoa.
Just a wild guess, madam.
The biennium, I can give you total about 3,000, okay. But that includes commercial airlines and ground transportation.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you all for being available. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 86? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 86. And Council, where do we stand on
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Whitney, you have in your file a no expenditure and no revenue impact statement. So this bill is ready to go.
Chair opens up a work session on Senate Bill 86, and we'll entertain a motion regarding Senate Bill 86.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 86 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 86 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And for the record, Senator Dingfelder had to be in district this morning, and so she will be marked as excused on the votes that we have today. And Chair's willing to carry this if anyone else doesn't want it.
What everyone do, Mr. Chair?
All right. We'll give Senator Boquist this one. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 87. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 87 comes to you at the request of the Department of Oregon State Police, would require a mental health care provider to notify the appropriate county medical examiner of a death and provide medical records, tissue samples, and other necessary material if requested to do so.
All right, I've got three people that are currently scheduled to give testimony. Proponent of the bill appears to be Karen Gunson. Karen, if you'll come forward, I'm going to go ahead and ask Gil Meyer and Andrea Meyer to go ahead and come to the dais since we have three chairs. And we'll let Karen start off when she gets situated.
Thank you, Senator Prosansky. My name is Karen Gunson. I am the state medical examiner. I'm a physician and a forensic pathologist, and I have been at the state medical examiner's office since 1985. I've been the state medical examiner since 1999. At the state medical examiner's office and in the county medical examiner's offices around the state, it is our job to investigate basically violent and unusual death. We look at suicides, homicides, accidents, drug overdoses, people who die in state custody, people who die at home who are not under medical care in the recent past. So anything that's non-natural falls under the medical examiner's law, plus many natural cases. 60% of our cases are natural. ORS 146 requires that certain people cooperate with our investigation so that we can look into the death of people. And I will quote here, ORS 146.100 requires all peace officers, physicians, embalmers, supervisors of penal institutions, and supervisors of hospitals or institutions caring for the ill or helpless shall cooperate with the medical examiner providing requested medical records, tissue samples, and other materials necessary to conduct the death investigation and shall make notification of deaths as required in subsection 3. Most of these people, the vast majority of them, the important part is making notification of the death that is required under law. Senate Bill 87 adds mental health care provider to the list of persons required to provide information in death investigations conducted by the medical examiner's law. ORS 146 requires that the medical examiner determine the cause and manner of death and certify that cause and manner of death on a death certificate. Our patients are not able to communicate with us, obviously, so we require histories in order to help us arrive at a cause and manner of death, as well as the autopsy or our physical exam. without that history, many times we cannot make the distinction between such things as suicide and accident if we have somebody who's died of a drug overdose, as an example. So we rely very heavily on those histories that we get from hospitals and other medical facilities. The cause of death is that injury or natural disease process that sets in motion the events that lead to death. Manner of death is how the death occurred. Is it natural, suicide, accident, homicide, or undetermined? If we can't get that type of information from mental health care providers, we many times have to put down undetermined as the manner of death, which is unsatisfactory many times for families and can even cost them money. If we had ruled accident, they would have gotten benefits from the insurance company. When I talk about mental health care providers, in my mind, I am talking about psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants. Psychiatrists are already covered as physicians under ORS 146. I want to assure you that the medical examiner's records are exempt from public disclosure. And so the mental health care or the mental health records provided by these people would remain confidential. The bill has no fiscal impact for us, and I respectfully request your favorable consideration in this bill.
All right, we're going to start with questions since we're getting this from the proponent. Senator Wissett.
Dr. Brzezinski. Dr. Goodson, is the term mental health care provider defined in statute?
Chair, Senator Wissett, no, not to my knowledge. It is not.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming, madam, when you're defining or when you're talking about mental health care provider, you're specifically addressing those who have the authority to prescribe a controlled substance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, no, I'm not. These are paraprofessionals who are many times under the control or auspice of a physician, but not always.
Some follow-up questions?
Yes.
Would any of these mental health care providers have the authority to prescribe a controlled substance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, it's my understanding that physician's assistants and nurse practitioners can provide prescriptions for things like antidepressants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Gunson, I guess I just want to clarify something that was put on the record. If your office determines that a person or can't determine how they died and puts down undetermined, does that somehow impact the ability for a family to collect on life insurance or any other type of insurance that might be out there?
Senator Brzezinski, yes, it can impact on that. Insurance companies do their own investigations prior to paying out benefits, and they rely on what we put on the death certificate in many instances. Undetermined would sway them into the position that this is possibly a suicide, and they wouldn't pay benefits.
So just again for the record, it sounds to me that if the state medical examiner is not able to put down, in this case, accidental or non-suicide death, that could, in fact, cause an insurer to take a position that since it hasn't been determined or it's, that it could have been, and for that reason, then there can be litigation over whether the contract on the insurance should be fulfilled by the payout of whatever benefits that were under that policy?
You are correct.
Okay. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that the converse is true, that if you leave it as undetermined because you can't determine the cause, the insurance company might continue to investigate, but if you determine that it's a suicide, then there would be no further investigation. They would rely on your report?
They almost always do their own investigation, even if I, you know, even if I call it a suicide. Some of the obviously some of the policies will pay suicides after after a certain time period, but they would do it much less extensive if I call it a suicide, and probably would deny benefits relatively rapidly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, can you give me just a, like an idea of the type or the number we're talking about here? I mean, what I'm looking for is, you know, how many times in a year or 2 years do you actually put forward a request, and is it only when you can't find something else and you suspect foul play, or what's the number of cases we're talking about? I'm not sure if cases is the right term given the situation.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Boquist, yeah, we use the term cases. We're not talking about a very big number of cases. I would say that in a year we're probably talking about less than 20, but more than somewhere between 10 and 20 cases.
Statewide?
Statewide. And so it's a small number of cases, but to the families it's an important number of cases.
10 to 20.
Council.
Chairman of the committee, Ms. Gunson, we had a conversation just before the meeting, and I had a legal intern from University of Oregon Law School do some research yesterday, and we cannot find in the statute, or any statute, that defines term mental health care provider, but there is a statute, 4230, that defines what a psychotherapist is. It means a person who is licensed, registered, certified, or otherwise authorized under the laws of any state to engage in the diagnosis or treatment of a mental or emotional condition or reason believed by the person so to believe to be while so engaged. Member, that include all the people that you were trying to put within the definition of mental health provider?
Mr. Chair, yes, Council, I believe it would. That they don't specifically name these people, but it this is the group of people that I'm trying to get to.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Gunson? If not, let's go ahead and start off with Ms. Myers. Sounds like you want to go first.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Gail Meyer, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys. I believe Ms. Andrea Meyer here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union is authorizing me to represent that my comments represent her comments as well. She may have to leave shortly. There's a few things of note for us that are of concern. Clearly there is an evidentiary privilege and a confidential relationship between a decedent and their mental health care provider. And by read of this statute, it would authorize the piercing of that privilege after the deceased is deceased. And yet the privilege survives death. So any licensed professional that has a confidential relationship and privilege with their patient or their client is obligated by that privilege even post-death. And so this statute does not deal with that dilemma. Now, I will acknowledge that the statute as currently written also obligates physicians to cooperate. And so the objection I'm raising today with respect to mental health care providers, quite frankly, would apply with equal merit to the existing inclusion of physicians there. But I do believe that that is a problem. I also, as a criminal defense practitioner, am mindful of what might happen when there is a parallel homicide investigation ongoing. So the medical examiner may have their medical examination ongoing, and there may be a parallel law enforcement homicide investigation ongoing. And so they may not know if it's a suicide or an estranged spouse who's responsible for the death. In that instance, as the statute would read, as amended by this bill, Senate Bill 87, it would suggest that the medical examiner could obligate other mental health care providers of suspects to cooperate with the death investigation. It would simply read, all mental health care providers shall cooperate with the medical examiner by providing requested medical records and other materials. And so we would at a minimum request that the statute be limited to make it very clear that the medical examiner is only authorized to get the mental health care records of the decedent and not any other third party. Thirdly, I would suggest that the best means here is to suggest that both the medical examiner and law enforcement can only have access to these records by and through a court order. Not by subpoena, but by a court order.
I'm glad it's been clarified. We're talking about 10 to 20 cases per year, and that's all. But I think a court is authorized, I mean, better in a position to evaluate the nature of the privilege and whether or not it should be waived or pierced post-death than would be any other entity. So my concern would be, again, if there was a parallel homicide investigation, the medical examiner might be able to go to the mental health care provider of the decedent. Law enforcement may really want those records. Currently, what I understand Ms. Gunson to represent is that she will not give them to law enforcement absent a subpoena. And that's fine, but law enforcement could simply subpoena her file and bring it to the grand jury, get into those records in the grand jury. The defendant, of course, or the suspect's lawyer, would never know those records had been produced. And so I would suggest that the statute should be framed such that the medical examiner can only get physician records or mental health care records by an order, by and through a court order, and I would suggest that that would be particularly necessary if law enforcement were seeking the medical examiner's records.
Right. I have questions, but other questions?
Go ahead.
Ms. Meyer, I agree from what I heard on the first one as to limiting it to the decedent. I think that's what was intended, and that can be taken care of. Regarding the use of the court order, it sounds like what your proposal would be to have it on the front end as compared to the, let's say, the secondary of them getting the records and then having a requirement of, let's say, the district attorney's office going through the court to order those records to then come forward. Does it really make a difference at what point the court order is obtained in the sense of going on the front end requiring the medical examiner's office to seek that, or if someone else wants to use it or attempt to get to those records, have to go through and get that order from a court at that time?
Mr. Chair, speaking purely right now as in the hat of the criminal defense attorney of some potential suspect, I would agree with you. It wouldn't really... if law enforcement had to go get the court order already in the position of the medical examiner, that would satisfy the concerns of the criminal defense attorney.
All right.
There might be other reasons why you might want to obligate the medical examiner to get a court order as well because of the privilege.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying, it seems like at this point what we already have on the books, and it seems like it's not caused a problem, physicians have that same privilege. And it doesn't seem like I've heard of any cases that have come to light where that has, say, been abused or a refusal. I assume a doctor could, in fact, refuse to, participate in the death investigation, which would then cause the medical examiner, if they wanted to go to a court to seek an order, which would be, you know, to require those records to come forward or have them to give them testimony as to that client-patient, right, doctor-patient relationship. So I'm not as concerned with what we have now. I do understand that we want to make certain that you don't have those records being able to be, let's say, circumvented to become accessible to someone else.
Correct. Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
I believe the purpose of the statute is to allow the medical examiner to determine the cause of death, and I think anything that would obstruct that would be inappropriate. I think that, to exclude the access to physicians and other medical care providers within the medical community would be counterproductive to the mission of the medical examiner. I do believe that it should be limited to the decedent, and I do believe that we ought to have a definition of a medical care provider. But to protect the confidentiality of the decedent, I don't imagine I have too many complaints from the decedents.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Just because I think we need to go someplace in the end, but I'm in concurrence. I mean, we need to define who the medical care provider is and if psychotherapist is the definition, or if a work group wants to determine it, that's fine with me. Like yourself, Mr. Chair, this is kind of deceased only as far as I'm concerned. But I'm an absolute no-go on court order in the fraud. I mean, I'd vote no on the bill if it came back in any form like that. I think all the reasons you explained are why I'd vote no.
All right. Other questions, or Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the points that Senator Boquist and Senator Whitsitt made about, and the Chair about defining mental health provider and about limiting the access to the decedent's records. I'm a little concerned about, because I don't remember much about the survival of the privilege and when that can be. I think the word you used was pierced. So I would certainly like some more information about the circumstances under which that's appropriate before I make a determination about whether I would support a timing difference on when a court order was necessary. So I guess I would like some more information on that, because if indeed the privilege survives, then I think it's problematic under the existing statute as well as under this bill. So I would like to have a briefing on that or more information about that.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did not personally check it, but our intern did, and he said there's a court case that specifically says the privilege does survive beyond death. I can email him and get the case and provide it to you. So.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Follow-up?
Yes.
I think it would be helpful to do that, because if we're going to be passing legislation that's going to create that's going to create this issue that's unanswered, then I think I'd rather have us address it now than through the court system later. So I would like some more information on that. Thank you.
Sounds like Ms. Meyer now wants to have a few words on the record.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. You will be faced with the challenge when both OCBLA and ACLU testify this session, as Gail and I have the same last name, spelled the same way, and we'll probably both respond to Ms. Meyer accordingly.
So we'll do G. Meyer and A. Meyer.
Sorry, you know, I actually will have no problem with informality, and you are free, and I would hope call me Andrea and Gail, and we have to deal with that. I just wanted to clarify in terms of our position, I believe, on the use of the deceased and qualifying it is not, from our perspective, simply to be the medical or mental health care provider records, but rather our recommendation would be that language would come on lines 24, the third word, after materials necessary, so that we're making sure that whether it's tissue samples, records of any kind related to the medical records of an individual, that it is of the deceased. And I wasn't sure if we were all clear on whether we were just parsing out one part or we prefer the whole thing. So with that said, I join in the approach the committee appears to be generally going, and thank you.
Dr. Gunnison.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring to your attention that HIPAA speaks to this particular area. I'm looking at, I never know how to read these, 45 CFR 164.512, and it's paragraph G.
Right. Can you go over and give us that one more
yes,
time?
Yes, I can actually provide you with this if you like. It's 45 CFR 164.512. It's paragraph G. And I'll just read it to you if that's okay. It says, standard uses and disclosures about decedents, coroners and medical examiners. A covered entity may disclose protected health information to a coroner or medical examiner for the purpose of identifying a deceased person, determining a cause of death, or other duties as authorized by law. So nationally, it speaks to this particular issue as far as who may provide information to the coroner or medical examiner. I just want to point out that this law has been extended, ORS 146, since 1964. If we were directed to get, we ask for medical records on a daily basis, and if we had to get a court order on every one of those, it would substantially increase our budget, and instead of being able to do a death certificate in a day, we would be looking at a month to 2 months on every case.
Yeah, I think members here understand that. I'll speak as a chair.
My goal is that we can have a little work group. It sounds to me that we're all on the same page as to the intent of this is for records of the only of the decedent. And also that the mental health care providers maybe should, that term should be substituted with psychotherapists. It's already defined under the statutes. That the use of a court order should be on, I'm going to call it the tail end, not on the front end, because we understand how much impact that would actually have on your office and workload, not only considering the financial burden, but the ability to actually be able to return more promptly the cause of death certificates so and everyone can be moving forward. And I think the placement of where Andrew Meyer has suggested for the term of the decedent or only the decedent is an appropriate place. So I'm going to ask y'all to work a little bit together, make sure we can kind of fine-tune this. I would like to get a little bit more information for Senator Bonamici as to making certain that we deal with this in its entirety, totality, instead of waiting for, quote-unquote, a challenge that runs it through the courts, and then we have to come back and make some type of modification. So is there anything that I've missed that we need to make sure we cover?
Chair Brzozinski, can I impose that? I don't know the law. I know Oregon has, I believe, some special protections on mental health records and mental health treatment and other things, so it would be great to make sure that we're not, as we expand this or more explicitly expand this, we make careful that we're not, that we look at that, because that would provide more protection than HIPAA does.
But, and that's what I think we have right now, and I think that's the issue. HIPAA says it's okay to do this, but we've got some limitations as to where it's at.
Right.
And so as states' rights, we can do that, but at the same time, look from my perspective, looking at the bigger picture, when you have a person who has died of what appears to be unnatural causes, it only makes sense that we want to identify how that person died for multiple purposes, and at the same time protecting and making certain that you don't set up a means to bypass the other benefits of having confidentiality privileges in the first place.
Chair, and what I'm suggesting is it's not just a privilege issue. I think there may be separate privacy laws in the healthcare records that I would want us to just make sure we aren't, that we review them to make sure that what you decide, and I agree with what you're proposing, that we create no unintended consequences. I just simply don't know that separate law.
Well, if we have other ones that are on the state level, then it would be basically using the terminology of something like notwithstanding identifying those for this purpose if we're going to move forward to clean this up. Any other comments or suggestions? We're going to go ahead. Let me ask if there's anyone else who'd like to come up and give us testimony on Senate Bill 87. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 87. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 89, and Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes in for the request of the state police. It exempts persons possessing a permit or license issued by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to possess, store, or manufacture explosives from the requirements to register with the state fire marshal.
And let's see, I have, looks like, two people that are currently scheduled to give testimony. Stacy Warner and then John DeLorenzo. Yeah, why don't y'all both come up here? Stacy Warner, I'm an assistant chief deputy state fire marshal. Excuse me. Well, the office of state fire marshal. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 89. Senate Bill 89 streamlines the regulatory process for the explosives industry by allowing industry compliance with federal regulation to satisfy the state requirement. After the attacks of September 11, 2001, Congress passed the Safe Explosive Act of 2002,
which expanded the authority of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives
for the entire explosives industry. At that time, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives began conducting criminal background checks and inspecting explosive storage magazines prior to issuing a federal license or permit. And they routinely reinspect these magazines on a minimum 3-year cycle as their licenses and permits expire and are renewed. This resulted in a duplication of effort since we'd been doing that prior to BATFP being given that authority. So this placed a burden on the industry by requiring them to pay both state and federal fees to meet duplicate state and federal regulations. This bill relieves the Office of State Fire Marshal from issuing certificates of possession and inspecting and registering explosive magazines. Instead, will accept the federal paperwork as compliance with the state regulations. We believe that once they comply with the federal requirement, there's no need to be doubly regulated by the state. This bill does, however, leave intact the safety provisions that are existing in the statute already related to notifying our Office of Magazine Movement so we can notify first responders when a magazine is moved into or out of their jurisdiction, the requirement to remain with a vehicle that's transporting explosives, not to leave it unattended, the requirement to report when explosives are stolen. Those pieces of the statute remain intact. It doesn't degrade the oversight of the explosives industry in any way. It just streamlines the regulatory process. And we'd like to ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just want to put this on the record.
I think you've done a good job of that, Mr. Warner. But basically, the State Fire Marshal's office will continue to do everything as currently done, with the exception that if there is a federal license that has been issued through the BTA, then there's no need for the owner or user of the magazine possessor to actually register, to get a license from the state marshal, but they still have the duty of giving notice of where it's at, when it's moved, and taking any and all safety precautions that are currently under the law in transporting any of those explosives.
Chair Pozanski, that's correct. It changes in no way their responsibilities related to the safe storage, handling, and use. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms shares with us their information, the magazine inspection reports, their location, the personnel who have licenses and permits issued by the BATFE, and the remnants of the statute, all the safety precautions and all the other requirements are still in existence. They don't change.
Great. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner of the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Oregon Fireworks Safe Practices Association in support of Senate Bill 89. The association is a trade organization which currently consists of Oregon's largest aerial display and retail fireworks companies. They are Western Display Fireworks Limited, Western Fireworks, and American Promotional Events Northwest. The organization was formed in 2007 for the purpose of promoting safety in the storage, transportation, and display of fireworks, and to work with fire safety officials and legislative bodies to foster safety in the fireworks industry. Yesterday, we had an opportunity to meet with Mr. Warner and other members of the staff of the Fire Marshal to make sure that we were all on the same page with respect to Senate Bill 89. It's our understanding that the purpose, as Mr. Warner said, is to eliminate duplication in enforcement. Senate Bill 89 amends the statute to provide that a person may not possess an explosive unless one of three conditions is present. One of that is having a license from BATFE that authorizes that type of possession. Our support for the bill, though, is predicated on our understanding that the term explosive, as used in ORS 480.210, does not include fireworks. We base that understanding on a separate statute that isn't printed in the bill, ORS 480.200 sub 3, which supplies the definitions for that section, and which states that explosive means a number of things, but excludes fireworks as the term is defined in ORS 480.110 sub 1.
therefore our understanding that if Senate Bill 89 is adopted,
the fire marshal will still retain jurisdiction over possessors of fireworks, and that is our interest in order to ensure safety with respect to fireworks. Thank you very much for hearing our testimony, and we're available to also answer any questions if you have.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for a question for the Fire Marshal's Office, make sure I understand here, and Counselor, I think you need to jump in here because I'm going to have to declare a conflict of interest here in a minute, but there is significant differences at times between the BATF and the definition in 480.110. I'm specifically interested in the federal definitions of 1.4A through 1.4G, and maybe including S category, in which BATF is doing a present review, in which many of the items that are in our fireworks would be converted over to BATF control. Are you familiar with that? And if the BATF or the federal law changes the definition of fireworks, how do we deconflict that? You'll have to get back to me, right?
Chair Buzanski, Senator Boquist. I'm not completely familiar with the federal, all of the federal laws relating to fireworks, their definition of fireworks. So I can't answer your question right now, but I'll do some research and
follow up, Chair. Just for clarification, so that you know what you're looking for, 1.4 categories all the way through S establish different regulatory requirements under the NFPA, which I know you're familiar with. And my question is that based on the definition I've never seen and just read that Counselor brought up here, I can already see that there's confliction in the future plans with the BATF plans to regulate it as explosives and non-explosives. And having said that, Mr. Chair, I think I need to declare a conflict of interest, too.
Okay. Well, we'll get there if we're going to do a vote. I think at this point it's fair to have for deliberations and discussions.
So I guess I'm going to come back, Mr. Warner. I think the other part to this, based on what happened after 9/11, it's my understanding the federal system start tightening down as to who would be monitoring, controlling, regulating the explosives. Has there been any indication from your office that the regulations that we continue to do for fireworks has been in jeopardy or in conflict with what the federal government is now, let's say, preempted the states on? It's not actually a preemption.
Not to my knowledge. Prior to the Safe Explosives Act of 2002, the BATF actually had very little regulation over the explosives industry, and they currently do very, very little, if any, related to fireworks. Only the larger, the 1.3G, the aerial display fireworks, the 1.4 consumer, what we consider consumer fireworks, they don't deal with at all currently. I'm not aware of what their plans are, but the regulatory scheme that we have in place now in the state related to fireworks is fairly comprehensive, and I'm not aware of any threat to that from outside currently.
All right. Any other questions?
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, the base standard for Oregon and the base standard for federal, which is under the National Fire Protection Association guidelines, I mean, they're exactly the same. They really are. The question is just turf battle issues.
All right. All right, so the chair is familiar with some of the stuff that we've done on regulation of explosives in the state prior to 9/11. And I think at this point, I do want to get some answers back to the committee to just make certain if we can figure out what, if anything, the feds may be looking at in the category of fireworks. I'm personally favorable to move the bill forward as long as we can answer those questions and making certain that we're not somehow setting ourselves up. But at the same time, knowing that I'm not sure what Senator Boquist information he has as to how they may be stepping into this field, but I do want to make certain that we have the regulations in place that we need, and at the same time not over-regulating and having even the permit holders to have to go through a dual process.
So if I think at this point, we're not going to try to, we're not going to put this in a work session, but instead we'll ask that the State Fire Marshal's office try to answer the questions that have been posed and then get some word back to council, and then we can get this set for a work session if we're ready to go forward or if we have more discussions. So let me ask if there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 89. Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close the public hearing. And our last bill that we have scheduled for today is Senate Bill 244. I'll open a public hearing on that bill and council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 244 comes to you at the request of the Oregon State Bar. The bill increases the size of the Board of Bar Governors of the Oregon State Bar from 16 to 18 by increasing the number of bar governors elected from districts from 12 to 14. Allows the board to establish special terms that are shorter than 4 years for the purpose of staggering the terms of the members of the board, includes public body and limited liability company when the term person for the purposes of unauthorized practices of law takes effect upon passage. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are also two sets of amendments in front of you. Clarifies the jurisdiction of the Oregon State Bar concerning the unauthorized practice of law and repeals statutes listed in your staff measure summary. As chair members of the committee, we do not have a fiscal impact statement yet as it relates to the amendments, but I expect it probably within a day or two. So,
Ms. Stevens.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. My name is Sylvia Stevens. I'm general counsel of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today in that capacity to speak on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in support of Senate Bill 244 and the Dash 1 and 2 amendments. As Mr. Taylor summarized very quickly, the bill and its amendments will make three changes to the Bar Act, which generally, as you know, deals generally with the governance of the bar and the legal profession and the practice of law. The first change is the addition of two lawyer members to the Board of Governors. As you may know, the Oregon State Bar is governed by a board that is comprised of 12 elected lawyer members and 4 appointed public members. The lawyer members are selected from regions that the state is divided into pursuant to ORS 9.025. In the distant past, or perhaps not so distant past, those regions and the composition of each region was embedded in the statute. In 1995, the statute was amended to allow the Board of Governors to configure the regions as needed because of demographic changes, and it requires every 10 years for the Board of Governors to look at the region configuration and adjust it as necessary to make sure that the representation of the lawyer members of the board is as equal among the different regions as we can. We last did that in 1997. In 2007, the board undertook that process again, and after a lengthy analysis, determined that the best way to approximate equality as best we can would be by adding 2 more lawyer members to the board. And in the materials I've provided to you are a couple of charts that show the current configuration of the board regions and how it's proposed to be with the 2 new members. What that will enable us to do is create 1 new region, 7, which would be all of Clackamas County, and also add a board member to what is region 4, where Washington County is, because there have been such growth in the lawyer population in those areas that they were really out of whack under the existing process. There's a lot of statistics here I can share with you if you're interested. The current deviation from equal representation is something on the order of minus 14 to plus 21. So there are some regions that are well underrepresented, some that are overrepresented. The proposal we have now will bring it much closer to equality. It's still not equal. It's a minus 8 to a plus 13. But it's very difficult to get completely equal because the whole east side of the state doesn't have a lot of lawyers, and it's big, and it skews everything. But this configuration that we're... Excuse me.
Oh, do we need to maybe put in the statute like we have for the census every 10 years, find out where the lawyers are, and we'll divide this up?
We know where the lawyers are. but anyway, this is the proposal, and it is dependent on having the 2 additional board members. The next change we're proposing involves prohibitions on the unlawful practice of law. ORS 9160 prohibits a person from practicing law unless they are a member of the Oregon State Bar. There is a corollary statute, 9.241, which allows the Supreme Court to adopt rules that would allow out-of-state lawyers to practice law in Oregon temporarily, and the court has done that through Rule of Professional Responsibility 5.5. What we're experiencing now is we're finding that there are lawyers from other states who are relocating to Oregon on a permanent basis and practicing law here without being licensed. Their argument is that they don't need to be licensed here because their clients are all in the state where they are licensed, and the law they are advising the client about is the law of that other jurisdiction. So their argument is we're not practicing law in Oregon. There's no case law in Oregon on point. All the case law in Oregon on unlawful practice deals with non-lawyer practitioners, and nobody's ever addressed this sort of where are you when you're practicing question. The Board of Governors created a study group which has examined the law in other jurisdictions, and we found while there's not much authority out there, it's all unanimous on the point that where a lawyer physically is present in performing the services is where they are practicing law for licensing purposes. We are thus proposing that the words in the state of Oregon be added to ORS 9160 to make it clear that you cannot practice law in the state of Oregon unless you are a member of the bar here or unless you fall within the temporary practice provisions that the court has adopted. We think that that will add some clarity and be helpful actually to practitioners who otherwise find themselves in some difficulty. The other change to that statutory scheme, as Mr. Taylor mentioned, is to expand the definition of who is a person for the purposes of unlawful practice. And there's been a definition for a long time that included corporations and partnerships and other associations. The language we're proposing would add limited liability companies and also clarify the scope of governmental bodies. The final amendment that we are proposing is a repeal of ORS 9.500 to 9.520. These are old statutes that have been on the books since at least 1953, and I suspect before that, but I wasn't able to clarify that in my brief research that I did. These statutes govern solicitation of clients, and you can tell their antiquated history because one of the prohibitions they have is against lawyers loitering outside of mills and factories to find clients, and I don't know any lawyers who do that anymore. In 1970, in 1970, the Supreme Court adopted the Code of Professional Responsibility, which was the first time in Oregon, and this was true nationwide as well, that there was a black letter enforceable code of lawyer conduct that addressed all sorts of conduct, including the solicitation of clients. That code has been replaced by the Rules of Professional Conduct, which are essentially the same thing with a new name. But these are the rules that lawyers are governed by that we use in disciplining lawyers and regulating their conduct. And what is in that statutory scheme is really antiquated, unnecessary, outdated, and somewhat inconsistent, where I think it sends mixed messages and creates confusion both for lawyers and disciplinary regulators so that removing them would be better. These changes that we're proposing reinforce our public policy that Oregon statutes are unambiguous in the regulation and licensure of the profession. They also will enhance bar governance by allowing us to change the board and reconfigure the regions. And I encourage you to move Senate Bill 244 with the dash 1 and 2 amendments forward with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, Stephen? Counsel.
Chairman of the Committee, Stevens, you mentioned that if a lawyer were in one state, they would be practicing there. So, for example, if a lawyer came down to Portland from Seattle on vacation and called back to a client in Seattle and gave that client advice, would he be considered, or she be considered, practicing in Oregon?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, yes, under our analysis, yes, that would be considered the practice of law in Oregon because the legal services are being provided while the lawyer is physically present in Oregon. However, we currently have a rule that is enabled by statute that says if you're only doing it on a temporary basis, it's okay.
Okay.
And what we have, and the problem we're trying to deal with this change, is lawyers who come here permanently. They retire, they relocate. An example I can give you is a lawyer who practices or was practicing somewhere in the Portland area. She's licensed in New York, California, and Washington, not in Oregon, but this was the only place she had an office. And her rationale for not having to be licensed was that her clients were all either in California, New York, or Washington. She was only advising them about the laws of that state, and therefore she didn't need to be licensed here.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little uncomfortable with certainly with moving any of this stuff today without spending a little more time looking at it.
We're not moving.
Okay. All right. I'm also a little concerned whether this last amendment is really within the purview of the relating to part of this this bill. And it says it's, you know, it relates to the Oregon bar, and that maybe that includes everything under law. But this is a changing a statute in, well, it's actually repealing by statute. So I think
all right.
I have some concerns.
So I guess regarding that concern, counsel, if you could have LC look at whether there might be an issue as to whether or not the relating clause
mm-hmm.
that's on the bill is broad enough for the dash twos.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I assume they are. Because otherwise we would have received a notice from legislative counsel's office. But if I could ask Ms. Stevens one further question. I assume that the reasons for removing a lot of these statutes is at one point when I first started practicing law, lawyers were not allowed to advertise. And that's been found unconstitutional. So my assumption that that is a removal of these particular provisions possibly are related to that, because if you are allowed to advertise, my assumption is you're allowed to solicit, too.
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, that's an interesting question, Mr. Taylor. There are still ethical rules that I'm sure you're familiar with that still prohibit certain kinds of advertising, prohibit personal solicitation of clients. Lawyers have been disciplined for violating those rules. I think that the main reason that we want to repeal these is that they have been superseded by rules of professional conduct that are enforceable. I'm not sure that 9500 to 9520 are enforceable either.
Okay.
But they were created when there was no code of conduct for lawyers beyond what judges could impose or statutes could restrict. We now have a full-blown code of conduct that addresses solicitation of clients in all respects, regardless of the type of matter that it is, so they offer better public protection and certainly more clarity to lawyers.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stevens, could you talk just a little bit more about the statutes that are listed as being repealed in the Dash 2 amendments, please, and just tell us a little bit about, I know you covered it briefly, but are they all statutes that are enforced or set up to be enforced by the Oregon State Bar, even though they're not being enforced now? Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, there is a provision in ORS 9.527, which is sort of a general catch-all about what the court can do with lawyer misconduct. And it was also an old statute, so it now encompasses violating the rules of professional conduct, but it also says violating these statutes. So there was a mechanism for the court to enforce these statutes, the 500 to 520. What they essentially deal with is solicitation of clients either directly in ways that are deemed improper or by the use of runners or by paying somebody to refer a client to you. Those are all things that, even with these statutes gone, there are still prohibitions in the rules of professional conduct that, again, have a broader scope because they apply to lawyers soliciting any kind of business where the statutory scheme is limited to personal injury cases.
Thank you.
Any other questions or thoughts? All right. So we understand we don't have the proper documentation to move this bill forward at this point anyway, and my I guess review of what the relating clause is to the Oregon State Bar should be broad enough to include those areas. But counsel, if you can just check with whoever the drafter is, just to make certain.
Steve Hendricks.
Knowing Mr. Hendricks, we probably would not see those amendments unless that. But let's just confirm that. Mm-hmm. And any other things we need to do on this one? All right. With that, I'm going to ask first: is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 244, Ms. Stevens?
I know you don't have a fiscal impact statement, but I can assure you there will be no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon because, as you know, the state bar does not receive any state funds.
Yeah. We have these formalities.
I've already had a discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 244. And, Council, I know that there's a field trip set for 1 p.m. today.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We're going down to Marion County Courthouse. There'll be a presentation from DHS on foster care, the number of kids in foster care. It's a follow-up from the meeting we had during the interim, and there will be a presentation on dependencies system on the judicial and for the DHS side.
And my understanding, if members can make the full event scheduled for about 2 hours?
2 hours, Mr. Chair, members.
And I assume that members who can't make it for the full time but would like to participate in part of it can either begin in the beginning or catch up wherever they're at.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And the only thing I want to give a warning is the last time I went down the courthouse, I brought my keys with me, and at my 20th anniversary here, I was given this, and I was not allowed in the courthouse because it has a one-inch blade.
All right.
So leave, just don't leave
these kind of things behind.
Okay.
All right.
Transportation's on our own now.
In my understanding, we're just talking two blocks down.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
If
anyone wants to go, they're welcome to come by my office beforehand. We can walk down together.
I need to clarify where it is because I would have gone downtown.
Yeah. Just straight down State Street.
Right.
One building
beyond. Take a left.
Where are you meeting at 1? At your office?
Just before 1 at my office.
At your office.
You know where the state office building is across the park? The white building, white marble?
Yes. So where the flag
beyond
display
the
is?
Flags.
On the other side of it.
It's,
that's the west.
That building, the next building down. They look almost identical. But glad to.
And it's basically in between States and Courts and Church and High.
That's correct.
All right. Anything else for the good of the order today? And today being Thursday is our last day to meet this week, so we're scheduled to be here on Monday, and I believe our start time is at 8:30. People could check that. With that, we'll close for today, and thank everyone.